So we can really power quite a bit of the country with wind. In the Northeast, we actually see it as offshore wind.
The North Sea is going to become the power plant of Europe.
In 2020, then Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson, said that wind farms could power every home by 2030. Very massive claim that he made. The vast, untapped potential of wind power is well known. But does this claim stack up? And what about the potential for wind in the United States? On the show today, we look at the devil in the details, and there are a lot of details to cover. We'll examine the policy, technology, and investment that's shaping the future of wind power here in the US. But I won't be going it alone. My co-host Laura is in Bilbao, Spain. Very jealous, Laura. At the Wind Europe conference to bring us the latest developments in wind from that side of the Atlantic. It's a three-day conference focused on the wind industry, showcasing the latest developments in the sector. So we, of course, had to be there. Laura, what is there to report?
Well, we had some amazing conversations at Wind Europe in Bilbao, Spain, and really excited that we got some captured for the podcast. First, we spoke to Giles Dixon. He is the chief executive of Wind Europe, and really it's the voice of the European wind industry. It represents, you know, hundreds of organizations and represents the entire chain, supply chain of wind power. So all the way from turbine manufacturers to different component suppliers, the power utilities, project developers, financial institutions and research institutions. So it really does cover all of these bases, and it's an association which, you know, covers a lot of this wind power in Europe. So here we go. Cannot wait to share with you the conversation I had with Giles.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined here by Giles Dixon, of course, Chief Exec of Wind Europe. And that is the topic of this conference, wind. Now, just how important is that when we are thinking about the clean energy revolution that we are looking to do?
So wind is 19% of all of the electricity that we consume in Europe. In the UK, it's even more than that. It's 29% of all the electricity people consume at home and in factories and shops and so on. So it's a very important part of the energy mix, and it's going to get bigger. So by 2050, the European Union wants wind to be over half of all of the electricity that we consume. Yeah, that means building lots of new wind farms.
Absolutely. And you spoke about the UK, you spoke about Europe. Of course, we've got the North Sea in between. How important is that collaboration between different areas for reaching not just one country's maybe net zero target, but actually moving the whole world onto this green energy?
So most of the UK's wind energy today now comes from the North Sea. There's still a lot coming from onshore wind farms, but it's the North Sea that is most of it. And that is the bit that's going to grow most, right? And it's not just the UK building offshore wind farms in the North Sea. It's all the countries around the North Sea, Norway, Denmark, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium. Yeah. And the North Sea is going to become the power plant of Europe. And the European Union sees it the same way too. Now, that's great, but it's important that all the countries around the North Sea collaborate and coordinate exactly what they're doing to make the most of this.
When you talk about that, I do get a bit excited, actually, about thinking all of the potential that is there. But of course, you've mentioned collaboration is key. What are some of the other challenges that really spring to mind when thinking about that, particularly cooperation and collaboration for really harnessing the potential for wind?
So countries need to collaborate on how they build the grid connections from all these offshore wind farms back to energy consumers. Today, all the wind farms in the North Sea just have one single and simple cable going back to the mother country, and that's it. Now, in the future, there will be wind farms that are connecting to each other across the North Sea. So there's a plan for one of England's offshore wind farms off the coast of East Anglia, obviously to have a cable back to England, but also to be connected to an offshore wind farm that will be in Dutch waters, yeah, which will also have a cable going back to the Netherlands. But this is interesting then, because the electricity can flow from the English wind farm, either to England or to the Netherlands, and from the Dutch wind farm in both directions as well. And this improves energy flows between countries.
So it's not just about the generation, it's also about the grid and about future-proofing it.
Yeah, but clearly countries need to be talking to each other to coordinate their respective investments, both in the generation assets and the transmission assets.
And of course, something like this, Wind Europe, where people are literally coming together under one roof, is an amazing opportunity to have those conversations. What are you most looking forward to? You know, we're about to start this conference. What are things that you've got in mind where you think that'll just be a great conversation to push us forward?
So we have 12 different government ministers from around Europe coming to this event. They'll be having some interesting political discussions with one another. We have lots of transmission system operators coming to this event. Obviously, we have Katie Jackson as the president of National Grid Ventures, but we also have the CEO of Elia, the Belgian TSO, the CEO of 50 Hertz, the German TSO, the CEO of TenneT, the Dutch TSO, and they'll be talking to the CEOs of the offshore wind farm developers, including about these wind farms in the North Sea that will have these interesting grid connection configurations and how they should coordinate their respective investments. Those will be very interesting conversations. Other interesting conversations, we've got the biodiversity NGOs coming because they are looking at the biodiversity impacts of all of these wind farms, both potentially negative, and where they're negative, we've got to manage that and mitigate, but also potentially positive, because we can do aquaculture and interesting things inside offshore wind farms. You're not disturbing the seabed. The fish stocks are higher because you've got all the shellfish on the foundations, yeah? You don't have bottom trawling inside the offshore wind farms. So how can we manage that in such a way that we have positive biodiversity impacts, as well as, of course, making sure we manage any potentially negative biodiversity impacts? So those are going to be interesting conversations between the nature people and the wind industry.
We are in a space full of experts from across different sectors and different countries who are so knowledgeable about this industry. But of course, a big part of energy and clean energy is communities, people who use it, people who rely on it. How do we bring people along, local communities along with us in the vision that we have for a clean energy revolution?
Wherever you build a wind farm, onshore or offshore, you have to engage the relevant local communities at the very earliest stage of planning that new wind farm. You've got to go into the village hall, show the maps, show where the turbines are going to go, explain it all to the local community and listen to their concerns and take their interests into account as you're developing that wind farm. Okay, you need to explain to the local community how they're going to benefit economically as well. So the onshore wind farms, they're paying taxes to the local council. The offshore wind farms and the onshore wind farms, they're creating local jobs as well. There are coastal communities in the UK that have been transformed thanks to offshore wind. I'm thinking of places like Grimsby and Blyth, you know, where they now have thriving industries supporting offshore wind. You've got to explain all of that to people so they buy in to the great vision we have.
Amazing. Well, I love that idea of collaboration and conversations all in one place. And thank you for having this conversation on the Clean Energy Revolution podcast. Thank you very much, Giles.
Thank you, Laura. It's been a pleasure.
Certainly something that came from Giles's conversation was this theme of collaboration and community engagement. And somebody I spoke to at Wind Europe knew all about that. So Matt Hind works for National Grid and he is the head of European affairs. So knows absolutely what it means to collaborate, particularly on those large scales. So here's that conversation. I think it's just full of amazing insights into the future of wind, renewable energy, and in particular that collaboration piece.
Matt, we are at Wind Europe, and of course one of the big pieces of the puzzle when thinking about clean energy revolutions really is about collaboration. And you know, we think about regions like the North Sea and just how many stakeholders and countries are part of that. Now your role is all about relationships and collaboration, and I guess I was wondering if you could just expand a little bit on what that means to you.
Sure. So I'm the head of the National Grid Brussels office, and I spend my time kind of like focusing on how do we get the UK-EU energy relationship working, and how does that help National Grid to deliver what we're trying to do in the North Sea, which is to build out the absolutely vast potential for renewable power in the North Sea, up to 300 gigawatts by 2050 in all of the European sectors, including the UK, with the 50 gigawatt target in the UK itself by 2030. And to do that, we really need to have effective cooperation between us.
For those who maybe don't know, how many countries does National Grid collaborate with when we think about the different energy partnerships that we do?
Sure. So we have interconnected with 5 countries around the North Sea. We started off in France in, I think, 1986 with IFA, Interconnexion France-Angleterre. Then we built Nemo Link with Belgium, BritNed with the Netherlands, North Sea Link with Norway, and recently Viking Link with Denmark, and not to forget IFA 2 with France as well. So that's about 7.8 gigawatts of interconnection. So that's a really substantial part of the UK's electricity system. And it's the kind of the first stage of the development of the North Sea. So overall in Europe, we've got an enormous target for renewable energy, 300 gigawatts thereabouts by 2050. In the UK, we've got an intermediate target of 50 gigawatts by 2030 and about 76 gigawatts in the European sectors. Now, that's an enormous challenge, and to do that effectively and in the most efficient way possible, we've got to be able to work together. And cooperation and collaboration is essential for this. It means we need to have kind of compatible regulatory systems. It means we need to be talking to each other. We need to be coordinated at every level, be it government, regulator, TSO, and we need to bring people with us as well.
Yeah, there's so many moving parts, different stakeholders, and we're of course at Wind Europe where many people are here. Just how important is a setting like this where we are literally under one roof for the kind of work that you're doing?
It's really important because, as I said, everyone needs to be facing in the right direction on this one. It's an enormous challenge to build out this amount of infrastructure. Take the 2050 net zero target, that's 26 years away. That's effectively one investment cycle. So we need to be moving quickly now. So having everyone here, from the OEMs, from the TSOs, from governments, policymakers, regulators, to have that shared appreciation of the challenge and the opportunities, but also what do we need to do to make this work, that's really important. And also, frankly, from a British perspective, it's really important we're here as well, because we're still physically part of the European energy market. And politically the situation has changed slightly, but we need to kind of make sure the system is working so we do have that level of effective cooperation.
I was wondering if you could just paint me a picture a little bit more about what day-to-day looks like for you in your role.
Sure. So I'm based in Brussels as the head of the grid office out there, and I spend my time working with member states, with the British government, with our partner European TSOs, and with the wider industry to encourage this cooperation, to encourage information sharing, and to make sure that the voice of kind of like British TSOs is part of this conversation as well. Because what's really essential is we work on a full North Sea basis. This is about the EU, but it's also about Norway and the UK as well. And that's really important. So we're very present in the debates in Brussels. We're very present in London making this case as well. Because as I say, what we're doing is building large-scale infrastructure on a cross-border basis, and that means at both ends of the cable we need to be aligned, we need to be facing in the same direction, and we need to be working on the same timetables.
Yeah, it is exciting, and I think it's about the collaboration on all levels, and we need the technology, we need the innovation, but of course we know that relationships are absolutely key to that. So it was fantastic to hear some of your insights from Wind Europe and also more broadly about your role, so thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this conference.
Thanks very much.
After speaking to Matt, it was really important that we also got to speak to Katie Jackson, who is the president of National Grid Ventures. And I handed over the Clean Energy Revolution podcast mic to Josh Atkins, who is a senior external affairs manager at National Grid Ventures as well. And they were talking really about the future of wind and renewable. And it was just great to hear Katie's insights. So let's roll the tape and hear just what she had to say.
It's been quite a big week for Katie, both at CERAWeek and at Wind Europe, with a lot of key topics discussed both on both sides of the pond. Katie, the first question is, what would you say your key takeaways from the two conferences were?
Well, I guess actually the two felt quite different, but standing here in Wind Europe, I guess my key takeaway from this conference is the scale. And I mean that in two ways. Firstly, I mean, I was amazed to see the presence here in terms of countries, companies, the number of halls, the number of stands, the number of people participating. This is on a huge scale. And I think commensurate with the fact that Europe has to see such a massive uptick in offshore wind as we head towards 2030. So I think we're going from 30 gigawatts to 300 gigawatts, and certainly there's a lot of people here who are very committed to doing that. It's quite different from CERA, where I think the discussion was much more about what is the pace of the energy transition fast enough, much more sort of US focused, the moratorium on LNG exports being another big topic. I would say the mood here is more upbeat, very much a sense that 2023 was a bit of a blip and the wind industry is sort of firmly back on the front foot in 24.
Great. So there's quite a lot of shared ambitions US to UK. Do you think that there's a kind of demonstrably different approach country to country, or even continent to continent, if you're factoring Europe into the equation as well?
Well, we've had Ashley Ibbett, one of the Director Generals from DESNZ, speaking here this morning, and he was very proud to talk about how far ahead the UK is in offshore wind. And I think that's true. So the US industry is at a lower state of maturity. But I think, I mean, it's actually one of the fascinating things about being in NGV, in National Grid Ventures, and seeing similarities and also the differences on both sides. I mean, one thing that I think is a common challenge is making sure that supply chain keeps pace with the very fast pace of development and the increase in the number of projects that's going on. And there's obviously here at Wind Europe a lot of presence from the supply chain, a lot of discussion about how they increase capacity, but also how companies like National Grid give them more sense of what's happening and in what time frame. One of my other takeaways from being here at Wind Europe today is that in terms of grid expansion, that is happening right across the globe. And so we are going to need more people at all sorts of, with all sorts of different skills and capabilities to help execute on that. I mean, I think we're doing a lot in terms of offering all sorts of community engagement, but also pulling in young people and new talent, from school age kids to apprentices to graduates to, of course, hiring people later in their careers as well. But I think, you know, with the level of growth we're looking at going forward, we only need to sort of keep going at that. I mean, you know, I'm obviously very convinced that it's a good thing for young people to do. And I can back that up by saying that I've actually nominated my son to go to our training center in Ekring for a week of work experience this summer. So he's 16 years old, and I'm hoping that he'll get the bug, basically, and consider a career in energy as well.
I mean, I have to say, as someone who's been in the industry my whole career, I'm obviously somewhat biased, but I think it's a very attractive one to be in. So it'll be interesting to see if we're the next tech, or we're the next, you know, big sector that is going to be hoovering up enthusiastic young people.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that we should be giving tech a run for its money. I mean, I think there are such a lot of green jobs that are going to be created over the next decade. And I think we as an industry will develop people who've got phenomenal skills, skills that will really set them up for success. So.
Thank you so much for joining us, Katie. I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you soon.
Thanks, Josh.
Hopefully you can just hear from those conversations that actually Wind Europe was a real place for collaboration and excitement. And I felt inspired actually about thinking the future of renewable energy and thinking about what role wind in particular has to play. But obviously Europe is just one small part of the puzzle. And so, Carolyn, just really excited to hear some of your insights from across the pond when we think beyond just the European boundaries.
Laura, thank you so much for bringing us all of that from your time in Bilbao, Spain. So exciting to see what's happening across Europe, and wonderful to have the insights that you shared with us.
I had such a great time at Wind Europe. Felt like I was, you know, a sponge that was just filling up with information. And it was great to see the landscape of how Europe is tackling renewable energy and, of course, in particular, wind. It feels exciting and innovative and creative. But of course, that really is just one piece of the puzzle. And Carolyn, I'm just wondering, could you paint a picture of what that landscape of renewable, but particularly wind energy looks like over in the States with you? Is America looking predominantly at onshore, offshore? What are some of the, you know, places for innovation and growth? What are some of the challenges? Yeah, it'd be great to know just a little bit of that context where you are.
So wind in the United States has predominantly been focused on onshore wind. So for example, if you were to go to the Lone Star State of Texas, Texas generates the largest amount of wind in the United States. But again, predominantly onshore. And that's where most of the U.S. development has been, is onshore. However, the next stage of wind development in the United States is set to be offshore. President Biden has very ambitious offshore targets. I'm sitting here in New York. We just opened our first offshore wind development, and there's a lot of new projects that are sort of in the queue.
And when you talk about those targets, you know, is that capacity? Is that a financial target? Is that number of projects? You know, what are those targets looking like for America?
Yeah, so New York has a target of 9 gigawatts of offshore wind. And we, again, just opened our first offshore wind farm, which is still providing in the megawatts, not hitting the gigawatt target. So we still have a long way to go. Offshore wind is very, it's a very complex challenge in the United States, specifically around, one, supply chain issues, inflation over the last 2 years, as well as a fair amount of NIMBYism, which sort of challenges some of the build and has made it difficult for some of the companies that have been engaged in offshore wind development in the United States. Wind electricity generation has grown significantly in the last 30 years. In 2000, wind generated 6 terawatts of power. In 2022, it was 434. That's quite a significant increase. Wind is the largest source of renewable energy, but there's so much more that could be done. But what's standing in the way of that exponential growth? Will Hazelip is president of National Grid Ventures for the United States Northeast. Will, a very warm welcome to you.
Thanks, Carolyn, and it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. You know, the United States is kind of blessed to have really good wind resources. We've been in the U.S., we've really been leveraging the onshore resources for quite some time, over a couple of decades. So a lot of that has been built. There's still a lot more. Really kind of getting into the onshore wind, kind of where it's located, that's more transmission constrained. So, you know, we're starting to see a need for electric transmission expansion to be able to access some of that onshore wind. But offshore is extremely exciting, is an extremely exciting opportunity, particularly for the U.S. Northeast, where we have really good wind resource. It's close to the coast, and which is where a lot of the demand is. Our big cities, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, DC, et cetera, they're close to where these offshore wind resources are. So one of the great things about this opportunity is that, you know, it can be connected right into those demand centers, and fairly minimal need for onshore transmission infrastructure, although that is an important part of it. And I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about that later.
I think we will, because that's come up in previous episodes in terms of just you know, addressing some of the transmission challenges, new infrastructure build, and how to get that, how to move that forward, how to accelerate it. So currently in the United States, I mean, wind actually accounts for the largest share of renewable energy as it stands right now. How much of the country's electricity could wind provide?
Yeah, well, today in 8 states, wind actually provides more than 25% of the electricity consumed, and there's over 146 gigawatts of wind power in the United States. So as you said, there's already a lot that's been done, but there's a lot more that can be done. I mean, it's really just kind of scratching the surface. So we can really power quite a bit of the country with wind. In the Northeast, we actually see offshore wind as being the largest kind of source of clean electricity. And that may be 30, 40% of the electricity that's produced, consumed in the Northeast, amounting to about 45 gigawatts. To put it in perspective, the total amount of power generation in New York State today is about 35 gigawatts. So, you know, when you think about the U.S. Northeast at 45 gigawatts, that'll be a significant contribution to the electric system from offshore wind.
What kind of timeline is that? When do you see that sort of us hitting some of those targets?
Yeah, you know, I'll say these targets are great. The ambition is absolutely necessary. So whether it's the 30 gigawatt by 2030 goal or the decarbonization goals that we have in most of the U.S. Northeast states, they're absolutely imperative to have those ambitions. It's not going to be a straight line to get there. But when we think about the 45 gigawatts of offshore wind in the U.S. Northeast, you know, we are starting to see some great progress. Before you know it, we'll have 3, 4, 5 gigawatts of offshore wind in the U.S. 45 gigawatts, I think, will happen in the 2040s.
So one of the big questions we've been kind of thinking about, you know, on this podcast is sort of thinking about connections, right? So if we think about how wind has historically been connected to the grid, and what do you see, how do you see it sort of changing in the future? Or will it not change?
Yeah, it certainly will change just by necessity as we scale up. And, you know, we actually saw exactly the same thing if you look back through history as the electric system developed. It developed with kind of small radial transmission lines, close the generation sited closer to demand. And then as we expanded, we had to change the approach from a transmission perspective. And now we have the grid that we have today. So actually, when we think about wind, it's very similar for onshore and offshore. So I mentioned onshore wind. A lot of what's been developed over the last couple of decades in the U.S. was generally sited as close to an existing transmission node, grid node, as possible. Well, now we're seeing projects that are having to think beyond that. So there's one example out west in New Mexico, very large multi-gigawatt onshore wind project with a very long transmission line from New Mexico to the Arizona-California border. So thinking about putting all that together, increasing the size of the network. We'll see the same thing offshore. So in the early stages, you know, we see these kind of radial connections from one project to the onshore network. In the future, we'll see multiple projects connect into an offshore network. So creating that more kind of complex electric transmission network structure to accommodate the scale and growth of the wind resources.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. We kind of started this conversation talking about offshore wind developments here in the Northeast and what's possible in terms of looking at the East Coast of the United States. As you outlined, right, there's a lot more potential and opportunity. If you could choose one thing to like move forward to harness that potential, what would it be?
Yeah, it's tough to choose one thing, but if you're going to force me, then I'm going to go with what we call commercial frameworks, right? So when we think about some of the recent challenges that offshore wind has faced, not just offshore wind, but using offshore wind as an example, we need to make sure we have commercial frameworks that can take into account the potential for challenges and kind of flex along the way so that these projects can stay on track. So I would say commercial frameworks that account for the risks, not just that we've experienced in the past, but that exist and that we could experience in the future. The last few years really brought a lot of that to light. And then durability. So there's some certainty that the industry can know that this is the way it's going to work, make their investments. And that has a trickle-down effect. So it's not just the developer or owner of the offshore or power generation project, but that trickles down to the supply chain. Offshore wind, in particular, is quite important that we build up the supply chain in the United States, the logistics infrastructure, the ships, the ports, everything that's necessary to deliver these projects. So that certainty is absolutely critical to give the industry a good firm foundation upon which to build.
Excellent. That was a fantastic answer. My next question is actually about state cooperation and sort of understanding how you see the opportunity. And I would also include the challenges, different U.S. states working together to deploy wind at scale.
Yeah, the cooperation among states is it's really critical. You know, I think it happens in ways that maybe we don't aren't explicit. And what I mean by that is actually, as states started to develop their targets for offshore wind, one state kind of fed on another. And that was a form of cooperation. Sometimes it felt like competition. But at the end of the day, it resulted in a significant amount of regional demand. And that was really important for giving a signal to the industry that, you know, the U.S. is ready to move forward with substantial investments in offshore wind. So I'll just say, you know, that type of cooperation was really important at the beginning to kind of set the scene and the market opportunity. Further coordination, you know, will be very helpful. And we're seeing some of that. So in New England, several states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, have gotten together to solicit for offshore wind energy in a joint fashion that allows them to look at different scale of projects than they would be able to on an individual basis. Also seeing states start to talk to each other and cooperate on investments in supply chain and logistics infrastructure. There's also, you know, a role for the federal government to play here to kind of bring it together. And, you know, we're seeing some of the agencies like BOEM and others kind of play that role and help to drive forward some collaboration amongst the states. And then importantly, also on the transmission side, the Department of Energy sponsoring studies about transmission infrastructure. I mentioned we'll need to see the transmission system evolve from kind of radial single project transmission lines into more of a networked offshore transmission grid. And the federal government is helping to move some of that forward. That grid will be much more effective if it's done in a regional, at least a regional fashion, you know, connecting states like New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts together. And that'll have benefits for connecting offshore wind into that system. But then there are also benefits that would exist today from having more robust connection amongst those states and regions.
Excellent. Gosh, I want to bring you into my class. That was a great explanation. Really helpful. Appreciate that. So one of the things we have talked about in previous episodes is communities and bringing communities into the process. But we've also, I mean, here in the United States, we also confront NIMBYism. And I would even go so far as to say a friend of mine who's a writer for The Economist calls it bananas, build absolutely nothing anywhere, nowhere, anyhow. So I'm kind of curious to get your take as to, how do you bring communities into it? And specific to offshore wind, given around the impact and what can be done to address some of that NIMBYism. And we've seen that for past projects.
Yeah, certainly. I would say this is the most critical thing that companies can focus on that are developing large-scale infrastructure of any kind, but large-scale energy infrastructure in particular. It's absolutely critical to change NIMBYs to, I just heard the other day, IMBYs, which is not a tough one. I don't know how to make the fruit, change the fruit analogy yet, but, but you know, we need to figure out how to get people saying, in my backyard.
In my backyard.
And that's really about addressing the impacts of these projects. And I don't mean the negative impacts. You know, that's certainly part of it. But there are so many positive impacts from energy infrastructure projects in particular. So for us, you know, the way we do that, our offshore wind joint venture, we named Community Offshore Wind. And we did that very purposefully to make it front and center, front of mind for everyone that this is about the communities and not just about an energy project. So set us up from the start that what we're doing is building something good for the community. And so we have to think about it that way. Think about what positive impact, positive benefit can we have for the community. So we develop a lot of programs. First of all, we spend a lot of time with the community understanding what would that mean. And it's different for different communities. You know, certainly in the Northeast and then you look around the U.S., it's different for different communities, what that means to them. So you have to understand that. You have to talk. You can't just rely on a permitting process. Permitting processes are important, but that in and of itself does not mean that you've done something beneficial for the community. So you have to take it upon yourself to focus on that, figure out what it is, and make that part of what you're doing. So for instance, you know, with offshore wind, impacts to fishermen are particularly important. So we work hand in hand with local fishermen to protect the ocean life and mitigate any impact on their industry. We've committed $38 million for wildlife and fisheries research, mitigation, and enforcement. So that's one example. You know, we also signed a groundbreaking cooperative research and development agreement with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that supports long-term planning. That's, you know, groundbreaking, and that no one else had done that. Having an open and honest conversation and dialogue with the communities, understanding that they're going to have concerns and not waiting to address those or hiding, be upfront. And then, you know, I think it's also how we show up, right? So the worst thing that a company could do that's developing, you know, a large scale project is to show up with an attitude that there's a process, we're going to go through the process, and this is going to get done to you. That's where we've seen the most challenge. Anytime a company has shown up with that type of attitude, it becomes clear and apparent to the community, and they react more to that than they do to the project. So the first thing is make sure you show up with the attitude of, we want to make this a very positive thing for the community, a positive impact beyond the point of the project. And if it does, if you can't do that, then you can't get the project done.
It's amazing. No, I really commend all the work that you're doing. I, you know, sitting here in New York at New York University, and, you know, what we're doing within the Energy, Climate, Justice, and Sustainability Lab to sort of move the communication forward. So really appreciate this opportunity to learn from you, to bring you in, to talk to our audience. It's really exciting to see the transformation that is taking place here in the United States, here in the Northeast, and the work that you're doing at National Grid. So thank you so very much for your time. Hope that you'll join us maybe again for another episode. Thank you.
Carolyn, thank you so much for the US insights into renewables and wind in particular. And thank you so much to everyone who was at Wind Europe for chatting to the Clean Energy Revolution podcast. And of course, thank you to all of our listeners. I hope you find this a really interesting topic to cover, something that's exciting and something that's insightful. And we look forward to having you join us on the next episode of the Clean Energy Revolution.
And we'll see you next month for our next episode. Thanks again for joining us. Thank you.